one of the things that the newspapers were predicting was that this could lead to their demise faster.
This is going to lead to the demise. I think that ship has sailed to some degree.
You know, I never realized I worked in the gig economy until you just now made me realize I was an independent.
You were an early adopter, Kurt.
Delivering newspapers.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the GeekWire podcast. I'm GeekWire editor Todd Bishop.
I'm GeekWire civic editor Monica Nicholsberg.
I'm Geek Life reporter Kurt Schlosser.
And John Cook, GeekWire co-founder.
This group has never been in the podcast together.
Is that true?
The four of us.
Wow. Okay.
The four of us.
Let's let it rip.
John, Monica, and I have been, but Kurt.
It's been a while that I've been in here with John.
Yeah.
But four of us together.
Yes, exactly. The four of us. Exactly. All right. So now that we've gotten the precedent set, we've got some fun stuff to talk about. Later on, we're going to dive into what Alexa does not know and how you can inform Amazon's virtual assistant. We're also going to be exploring a new smartphone that promises to be the antidote to your iPhone or your expensive Samsung device. But first, let's talk about the gig economy, because there were some fascinating developments this past week. Let's actually start with Amazon, because there was a letter from three U.S. senators sent to Jeff Bezos, made public immediately. Are there ever any private letters from U.S. senators to heads of big corporations anymore?
It's hard to say, but I think a big reason that senators send these letters is for the media coverage, because they want to show that they care about an issue.
This got right to the heart of a very timely topic right now, which is independent contractors and their role in technology. Who were these three senators and what did they say to Jeff Bezos?
So the senators are Elizabeth Warren, Richard Blumenthal, and Sherrod Brown. And they sent a letter to Bezos asking for more information about this vast network of third-party contractors that Amazon relies on to deliver packages to customers' doors.
This is the Delivery Service Partners Program, which is essentially a way for Amazon to have independent companies delivering their packages in a way that reduces Amazon's liability, its overall costs. It's actually in some ways kind of a genius program, but perhaps too genius based on what these senators said.
Yes, they did not mince words. They said, quote, "Amazon has created a system of deception using a variety of underhanded tactics to skirt Department of Transportation oversight and legal accountability."
Lots of good verbs in there. Man, they've got some staffers who know how to write.
They do. But we should probably back up and explain what's going on here. So the network of independent contractors that Amazon uses has come under fire recently in reports from BuzzFeed News and The New York Times and ProPublica, because there have been at least 60 accidents associated with this program. And the contention of the reporting is that a lot of pressure from Amazon combined with not a lot of oversight and legal compliance of who these drivers are and not much training results in a really high human cost for two-day and one-day delivery.
So this ties into this much larger debate over independent contractors and the gig economy, and there was news out of California on that front this week as well.
Big news, yeah. California lawmakers passed a bill that makes it a lot harder for gig economy companies like Uber and Lyft to classify workers or drivers in their case as independent contractors. There's a new test and new standards that have to be used, and they pertain to things like whether the workers are doing something that's core to the company's business and whether the company exercises a lot of control over how they do their work. So it's got the gig economy very concerned. California is a huge market and where many of these companies are headquartered. And there's going to be potentially a ballot initiative and a lot of legal challenges to determine whether or not these workers need to be classified as employees and get employee benefits.
So what does this mean for Uber and Lyft and the drivers? I mean, are they automatically now being classified as full-time employees of these companies?
No, not automatically. And that's why I mentioned the legal challenges, because it's going to take a while to figure out what this actually means. I think the philosophy of the law, the impetus behind it was to get these companies to reclassify their employees. But Uber's chief legal officer, Tony West, has said they're not going to do that. And their argument is that drivers are not part of Uber's core business, that their core business is building technology products and providing a variety of transportation options like their Jump e-bikes, and driving is not core to the business.
Yeah, because robots are. Because all these people are going to be replaced anyway, correct?
That is one school of thought, that Uber and Lyft are kind of just towing the line and trying to keep drivers on board for now until their self-driving technology gets robust enough. But there's also, I mean, I chatted with one expert who said that these companies should just kind of abandon ride hailing and go deep on like scooter sharing, bike sharing, and new mobility models that don't require drivers, you know, because their business model doesn't really work if these drivers are employees.
That's not going to happen.
It's, they're too far. I mean, that would have had to have happened before they went public. Right now,
I'm going to take my scooter down to the SeaTac for my next flight out.
Strap your luggage on your back.
That's right.
Personally, I think this is pretty wild for me. I always tend to reference this, and lately I'm seeing more and more of those Amazon vans on the street, you know, the smile on the side of it. And, you know, every time I get an Uber, I think about this. My dad was a UPS driver for 25 years. It's a big part of my childhood, hearing his truck in our neighborhood. UPS is certainly still a major player today in the delivery space, and they're innovating in their own way. But I do think about it every time I see one of these gig economy drivers, whether they're for Amazon or Uber or Lyft. And I think about my dad and how proud he was of his safety record and the fact that he's comfortably retired on a Teamsters pension. What would it be like to be one of these drivers with this sort of this question mark hanging over how you make a living?
But aren't many of the drivers that you interact with and kind of the impression is it's this flex work that they really enjoy and love? And when your dad worked at UPS, I'm sure he was given the schedule that he had to go and perform and to deliver the packages that day. The beauty of this for the driver, and in defense of them remaining as contractors or independent contractors, is that they can choose the schedule they want to work. And a lot of people do this as moonlighting, as a second job. They're on and off at different times, and they really are kind of calling their own schedule. If they're truly employees, they're going to have a different regime.
The question here, though, is about the safety net. Like Kurt's dad, he had a company that was ultimately liable for anything that went wrong, and he, I imagine, had to undergo more training than these drivers, and there are Department of Transportation regulations governing how he does his job to keep people safe. Those things are not really in effect with these gig economy services. And in the reporting that sparked these senators to write this letter, the reporters interviewed a lot of folks who got into fatal accidents, who in some cases killed another person, and they were completely on the hook for it themselves. They were not backed at all by the company. In fact, the company sometimes sued to have their legal fees covered. Amazon sued to have their legal fees covered because they didn't want to be associated as liable in any way. And so that's not really a lot of job security.
Well, this is a great discussion and debate that ties into a really big theme of regulation not being adapted quickly enough to the changing business models and changing technology. So just yet another example of that.
Yeah. And to that point, I know that there's a discussion in California about creating a new category of worker that would essentially apply to these gig economy drivers, workers, all sorts of gig economy jobs, where they would neither be employees nor contractors, but somewhere in between with special rules and requirements.
In regard to your point, John, maybe the robots or the autonomous vehicles can't come fast enough. If we're looking at people doing these flex jobs after working 10 hours somewhere else all day, and then like, well, I'm going to go drive around, throw a couple packages on some porches, and they're compromising their own ability to get that job done safely, then maybe the robot is the answer.
The bottom line question is, do we need to totally rethink the social safety net? Because right now it's written for a very different economy, one where most people who work are employees of the company they work for. And that's changing. Work is becoming a lot more flex, a lot more contingent, and we don't really have protections in place for the workers who are shifting to these models.
One thing I do want to make sure we note, we're conflating a couple of different Amazon programs. Amazon has its Flex program, which is much like Uber for packages. And so that is contractors who drive for Amazon, not as employees, but as contractors. Then separately, you've got this delivery service partners network. This is, as I read it, primarily the subject of the letter that the senator sent to Jeff Bezos. This was the program that Amazon created last year, where they helped to create independent delivery companies across the country. And then those delivery companies actually employ a series of drivers. So basically, Amazon's pitch there is, oh, hey, we're just creating a bunch of small businesses, and those small businesses employ people. In reality, Amazon is distancing itself further from the worker and from the liability there, and also from the financial risk. These small business owners, we've documented this, the finances are tough. It is long hours and thin margins, and it's difficult. So if anything, I think some of this scrutiny should be placed on whether the people who go into this program as owners of these delivery service partners' businesses are getting a fair shake.
There are a few different types of delivery couriers that make up this network of independent contractors that Amazon relies on. There's the individuals who drive their own cars, part of Amazon Flex. There's the delivery service partners. And then there are more established delivery companies that Amazon contracts with that as well. But the bottom line is that Amazon says these companies, whether they're individuals, 10 people, 100 people, are responsible. They're left holding the bill. They have the liability if anything goes wrong.
So going back to California, what are the next steps there? What happens next? And how does that impact everybody else?
So Uber and Lyft are pouring millions of dollars into a campaign to get a ballot initiative that would exempt them from the new law on the ballot in California. And that would also implement new protections for their drivers. So it's kind of a compromise. It's this idea of portable benefits that follow the worker around versus benefits that the company is required to give employees. So that campaign is underway, and we'll see what happens with it. And I think we can also expect to see a lot of legal challenges to really hammer out who this applies to and in what way.
It's not just transportation, though, correct? I mean, this also applies to other gig economy jobs. So, for example, there's a gig economy company based in Seattle, Rover.com, the dog walking service. Is there any impact to companies that are outside transportation, which we've largely been talking about here?
There is, yeah. And Rover says that they will largely be exempt from this new law. There are a lot of exemptions that they just don't happen to apply to Uber and Lyft. And so that's why they're really in the hot seat here. But it applies to any company, pretty much, with the exception of the exemptions, that hires independent contractors. And there are a lot of companies that do that that we don't necessarily think of. Google, for example, has tens of thousands of independent contractors.
The other thing that I saw was newspapers down in California are concerned about this because the people who do the newspaper routes, yes.
The delivery.
Yes, that still exists. Like the original gig economy, they are worried that this is going to apply to them and put new restrictions on the newspapers. And one of the things that the newspapers were predicting was that this could lead to their demise faster.
This is going to lead to the demise. Well, I think that ship has sailed to some degree. But
no, it could accelerate
it could
their
accelerate.
Demise. Yes.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That's an amazing fact. I never realized I worked in the gig economy until you just now made me realize I was an independent
contractor.
You were
an early adopter, Kurt.
Delivering newspapers.
Yeah. Oh, hey, if you want to go deep into work history, I was a Teamster. I worked at UPS during college. It was a perfect part-time job. But I was an employee, to your point. It was a part-time employee. I was not a 1099. I was a W-2. So, yeah, it's interesting. That was the traditional way to do it, even if you were working part-time.
Well, one of the big themes that I think is coming across here, not to change gears off your beautiful history of working at UPS in the early days, but I'm curious what people think about this idea. This is part of this growing momentum, what we talk about as the tech lash. Is this just a continuation, another form of this anti-technology, anti-big tech companies innovating and creating new services? Is this part of that, or is this deeper?
I don't know. I mean, there's certainly no shortage of skepticism or even hostility toward the tech industry right now. But to me, this goes more to the changing nature of work and the labor force and this feeling of anxiety among workers that there's just not the same level of protection that maybe their parents or previous generations had.
We will be right back with a discussion of a smartphone that might just be better or at least cheaper than your iPhone. That's coming up next on GeekWire.
Technology moves fast. I need to move faster. WGU's competency-based education puts me in control of how fast I move through my IT degree program. I can accelerate my program by applying what I already know to my courses and focusing on the things I need to learn. Earn a respected accredited degree that propels your career in the IT field. Learn more at wgu.edu/IT certs included.
Welcome back to GeekWire. It's Todd Bishop with Monica Nicholsberg, Kurt Schlosser, and John Cook. And you might have noticed this past week Apple had a big announcement.
Really?
Yes. Yes. The new iPhone, 3 cameras. Did you see this thing?
I did.
Yeah. Are you ready to upgrade, John?
No. Not until I lose or break my phone.
I've totally tuned out since I switched to Android.
Yeah, me too, Monica. I'm all into the Samsung Galaxy Note.
I don't believe
you. Except for the iPhone I'm still carrying around.
You have a closet iPhone. I know it.
Kurt, you though covered the other side, the flip side of this story through the lens of a Seattle startup that kind of tried to ride on Apple's coattails a little bit with something that was completely the same yet totally different. Tell us about TerraCube.
You know, I think the story does kind of hit me in the wallet, if you will. I am one of those people who gets a new phone every couple of years because I am swayed by the camera technology and how it keeps getting better and better. I probably won't get an iPhone 11, but iPhone 11s could be in my future. And this TerraCube, founded by a couple consumer electronics vets, they're out in Redmond. They launched a Kickstarter just yesterday for their smartphone product, which they bill as better for your pocket, better for the planet. They said that it has all the bells and whistles of the smartphones that we're used to, Android enabled. They list several carriers that you can get on this device. And the suggested retail price is only $350. And on Kickstarter, they were offering them at $175. And it's got a dual camera. It's got all the storage capabilities and speed. It's got this fancy processor in it. And, you know, the hook is that it's got a 4-year warranty. So people like John, who might drop the phone while walking the dog or whatever and are outside of their Apple Care, can still take a phone like this back, get a new battery put in it, get the glass repaired, get any other fixes done on it, up to 4 years. And that, they say, is a world best offering.
Now, I hope these guys do well. I hope this company does well, because obviously this is a good Seattle startup story, but it's also an interesting story for the environment. Sometimes I look at these Kickstarters and I worry.
Yeah.
And I know they have experience at Microsoft and Amazon, and they're veterans of the industry. But there's a reason that Apple has thousands and thousands of engineers working on a smartphone. I am a little bit appropriately skeptical of this. Let me just say that. I don't want to...
For privacy or security
just,
or what's
just
the...
overall functionality. I could tell that the phone that they showed in the Kickstarter video, it was clearly a mock-up.
Okay, so we haven't seen one of these in the wild.
I don't believe so.
I haven't seen one of these. And in chatting with Sharad Mittal, one of the co-founders, you know, my first question to him was, you know, I've been getting iPhones for 11 years, and why would I switch? And why would I trust that your hardware and software are any better? And he said the challenge for them is not in building the product. You know, he said that rather confidently. He said the bigger challenge is to get users like myself, who are ingrained in the phone ecosystem, to actually switch. Because we've all been, as he said, misled by corporate marketing that tells us we need a $1,000 phone every 2 years. And, you know, he bills himself as a passionate environmentalist who wants to reduce this e-waste, if you will.
Maybe so if Amazon can't make it in the phone business, what gives you confidence that TerraCube can make it?
Well, all they have to do is hit their Kickstarter goal, which they've already done, right? They were seeking...
and then it's successful?
Well,
that's all they need to do?
As a first step. I mean, you know, they were seeking...
Wow, they're just that easy.
Yeah, they were seeking $25,000 and they already have raised $35,000. But that's only from 200 backers, to your point. And you're talking about Apple and Google, which have, you know, tens of millions of users cumulatively. So yeah, that is... I don't know. It'll be interesting to see how this one goes. I'm a little bit skeptical.
I do get the e-waste argument, though. I mean, I don't think I would switch, but I have a basket of electronics in my home dating back to my, like, 10-year-old laptop that I used in college, because I just don't... I have all this anxiety about getting rid of them, and I know there are things you can do, like you wipe the devices and you take them to a special e-waste collector, but I've never done that. So I have so many, like, broken iPhones and this graveyard of technology, because we replace it so frequently, and I just don't know what to do with it.
Well, if you want to try it out for yourself, the Kickstarter is still live, even though they've reached their goal. There's 34 days to go in the Kickstarter. So you can try one of these for, you know, a relatively small investment. As you were saying, Kurt, during the Kickstarter, the pre-order is only $175. That's, you know.
We need to test one out.
Yeah, we should. We should go ahead and sign up for this. Have GeekWire get a TerraCube phone.
You can have a third phone in your pocket.
Exactly. All right. So you can check that out. Check out Kurt's story on GeekWire. And that's a story we'll be following as it progresses. Welcome back to GeekWire. It is time for the Random Channel, that moment of the week when we talk about some of the random items we were buzzing about behind the scenes this week. I was probably most fascinated by this revelation about Taylor Swift that you covered, Kurt. Do you want to make that your random channel to start things off?
Yeah, sure. I can talk Taylor Swift. Imagine getting this email, Todd. We represent Taylor Swift, on whose behalf this is directed to you. Now, that's an email from a Beverly Hills lawyer, and it came to Brad Smith. he recounts in his new book, Tools and Weapons. And the purpose of that was because Microsoft at one time had this chat bot that was originally launched in China under a different name. And it was a great success over there. It was like a social bot that people used to answer questions. Did you remember when this happened?
Yeah, Xiao Ice. Yes. It was one of the early examples of a chat bot that worked really well. In fact, Microsoft's measure of success with that over in China was the fact that it had people telling it that it loved it.
Well,
like the users would say.
And then it came
and then
to the
it
U.S.
Came to America.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
America destroyed
it. Like literally, they would be in chat conversations with this chatbot, and they would tell, I don't know if it was what gender this was, but they would tell the chatbot that they loved it.
Well, Brad Smith, in his book, in a section in his book.
His tell-all.
It really is. This illustrates.
He has a revealing section on the world's different tastes in technology and how when they brought this chatbot to the U.S. and named it Tay, this unfortunate series of events unfolded. The first of which was that Taylor Swift's representatives did not like Microsoft naming its chatbot Tay, a name commonly associated with the pop star. Secondly, the bot was quickly commandeered by trolls on Twitter and turned into a racist, and Microsoft had to take it down and apologize, and ultimately the thing was killed and then relaunched under the name Zoe a few years later, and now it avoids discussing anything related to politics, race, and religion.
Oh, yeah.
But the original bot learned from the real humans who talked to it, right? So that's how they were able to teach this artificial intelligence racism.
Yeah, the trolls are pranksters, as Smith referred to them in the book.
Pranksters.
those Twitter pranksters, I tell you. They quickly trained Tay how to say a lot of really awful stuff.
Yeah. Well, we should note, if you missed it, we interviewed Brad Smith about his book. We did not talk about Taylor Swift. We had a couple other more meaningful things to talk about with him in our most recent episode of the GeekWire podcast, one episode back in your feed. Monica is also speaking with Brad Smith at an event coming up on September 20th.
That's right. I'm interviewing him at Town Hall in Seattle. Come see it. It's going to be an interesting conversation.
And Brad Smith is, of course, one of the headliners at the GeekWire Summit, which is coming up October 7th through 9th in Seattle. And you can find out more about that at geekwire.com/summit. How's the summit coming together, John?
It's looking good. Got a great lineup. I'm excited about some of the panels we have. I think, Monica, you're going to be doing a really interesting panel kind of on the future of law enforcement, talking about facial recognition and all sorts of nitty-gritty details with the president of Axon, the Seattle police chief.
Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal.
That's right. Yeah, we got a good lineup on that one. So other panels, future of food will be interesting. We've got Steve Ballmer, of course, coming back on stage with us, which was always fun.
One of the new additions is a commissioner from the FTC.
That's right. Commissioner Rohit Chopra is joining us. He and I are going to be talking about all of the antitrust issues that are plaguing the technology industry. And I'm really excited about him because he tends to take a more controversial position than some of his colleagues on the commission.
And of course, don't forget others, including Expedia CEO Mark Okerstrom and Amazon Devices and Services Chief Dave Limp, plus the finals of the elevator pitch competition, season 2.
It's going to be fun.
All right. You can check out more about that at geekwire.com/summit. I don't know how that turned into an ad, but it did. All right. So speaking of the pranksters on the internet, there was a feature that came out from Amazon this past week that has the potential, at least, to do the same thing for Alexa. It's called Alexa Answers, and it's basically Amazon's attempt to crowdsource Alexa's database. So there are certain things, if you ask Alexa, she won't know the answer to. And this is one place where Amazon is actually far behind Google, because Google obviously has a giant search engine. So Amazon launched this new thing called Alexa Answers. And the whole idea is that you can go into this portal and you can see questions that are stumping Alexa. And if you provide the answers, you then are able to move up the leaderboards.
Oh my God.
They gamified it, John.
This is so awesome.
They gamified it.
So, it's so wrong, but so brilliant.
Yeah, exactly. So I kind of look at this as the way that if somebody were to land on Earth with robots and decide that they were going to try and suck up all the human knowledge out of the sentient beings on the planet and get it into the AI, how else would you do it but launch a game? It's exactly like we're totally sucked in. So I've got a list here of the questions,
okay,
some of the questions that Amazon is looking for answers to. So first off, let's see if Alexa can answer this one.
Alexa's supposedly not able to answer, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
So let's test that. So here's one. Alexa, What is the fear of caves?
Sorry, I don't know that one.
All right, so it's true. So that is one of the things. Do you happen to know what the fear of caves is?
Spelunknophobia.
That's exactly it.
Is it really? No.
I'm
way.
Winning 1-0.
That is awesome.
Yes, wow. Yes, I was looking. And here's the problem, though. You know how I figured that out? So, yeah, spelunkophobia. I Googled it.
Pretty close.
I mean, it's like, What an inefficient thing. Like, if Amazon could come up with that answer to ask people, why couldn't it just Google it?
Now, has Alexa gotten smarter here as a result of our interaction?
No. So
you
what
have
happens
to be
is,
in this portal in order to...
Exactly.
Okay.
You're in the Alexa Answers portal. But you can imagine the potential here for pranksters to take over.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes, exactly. But Amazon says they have protections in place. I assume they're just reviewing them. And actually, the upvoting of the different answers is also another way to put in safeguards. I don't know. It just seems like this weird engagement thing that makes me wonder actually if there isn't some other ulterior motive here for
getting
them
on the GeekWire podcast.
Maybe that's it.
Maybe, yeah. So every answer could end up being like Bodie McBoatface. On,
exactly.
You know. Yeah, we should test those protections.
You know, that exactly. makes me think while we're sitting here, wouldn't it be cool if you could ask Alexa that question? She doesn't know the answer. And then you tell her the answer and then ask her again and she knows it.
Yeah, like, that's what I was thinking.
I mean, why go through all these hoops of having to...
It would be nice, yeah.
I'm sure the engineers are working on it.
I got to go. My Amazon interview is at 4 o'clock.
All right, well, that's all I got. Alexa, do you have anything else to say?
I pronounce that anything else, but I'm always working on how I say things and I might not have it right.
All right, we need to do a little more work. I'm going to talk about this with Dave Limp at the GeekWire Summit. All right, until next time, I'm Todd Bishop.
I'm Monica Nicholsberg.
I'm Kurt Schlosser.
And I'm John Cook.
Thanks for listening to the GeekWire podcast.